right. Mommy's all right. Daddy's all right. They just seem a little weird. Surrender, Rockford's Cheap Trick with John Landecker at 720 WGN. They just seem a little weird is also the title of an extensively in-depth book called, did I just say it? Yes, I did. They just seem a little weird. And with us is the author, Doug Brode, who, let me give you a little background, longtime editor at Spin magazine, Entertainment Weekly, worked at Atlantic Records, taught at New York University, was a segment producer for MTV, written for the New York Times, Billboard, Classic Rock, the Toronto, the Hollywood Reporter, and the Trouser Press Record Guide. Good evening, Doug.
Nice to be here, John.
What the heck is the Trouser Press Record Guide?
This great book.
I'd not heard of that one.
It's an offshoot of a magazine from the 70s and 80s called the Trouser Press. It was published by a gentleman named Ira Robbins, who's actually a good friend of mine. And the Trouser Press Record Guides basically are these great reference guides to great new wave and punk albums.
Cool. Well, you see, I can learn something new every day. Because obviously I've heard of Billboard and Classic Rock and the Hollywood Reporter and Spin and all of those. I got to say, you have written the most exhaustive, detailed, in-depth book about bands and rock and roll that I think I've ever seen. I mean, and you only deal really with Kiss, Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, and a band that I'd like you to start off with, Stars, spelled S-T-A-R-Z.
The book has been probably 2 years in the making, and for it, I interviewed around 136 people. Yeah. It's pretty, like you said, it's pretty in-depth.
Yes.
With the book, I tried to tell a story of 70s rock that hadn't been told before. So I looked at these four bands, Kiss, Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, and Stars. They had a lot of connections. Some of them toured together. They shared producers. Some of them shared management. There are a lot of connections with these bands. And in fact, members of all four of the bands played on Gene Simmons' 1978 solo album when Kiss did their four solo albums. So you had Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick playing guitar on it. You had Joe Perry from Aerosmith guesting on guitar. And you had Richie Rano from this band called Stars playing on that record as well. And Stars is an interesting story. They're the second band that was managed by Kiss's manager, Bill O'Coyne. They had a lot of the same opportunities as bands like this, but they never really made it. And I have them in the book in a way to investigate why this band that had so many opportunities wasn't able to step over the finish line.
Yeah. I mean, that's the stuff of which I think a great movie would be made. I mean, seriously. I mean, you could make a movie about Cheap Trick. That'd be great. You could make a movie about Aerosmith and Kiss and all of that. But a docudrama about a band that was, in your opinion, obviously on the same level as the other three bands I've mentioned, yet did not break through, and what it was that caused that. Is it okay for you to say what it was, or do you want to hold that off so people will read the book?
I can give you a little sense of it. I mean, it's interesting. Besides being, under Kiss's management, they opened for Aerosmith extensively throughout their career. They were only around for a few years. They had four albums on Capitol Records. They had Jack Douglas, who produced Cheap Trick and Aerosmith records. He produced two of the Stars records. There are a lot of theories that I get into in the book, one of which is probably the most the major theory, is that they just didn't have a song that succeeded as a pop hit on the radio when all the other bands did. They had a song in 77 called Cherry Baby that went to number 33 on the Billboard chart, but it kind of stalled out there and didn't progress. So that was as high as they got it. And back then in the 70s, you know, for a rock band to be really successful, they had to have songs on the radio, and stars just couldn't get them on the radio.
What about the shocking act of violence?
That you can read in the book, but I'll tell you a little bit about it.
I read the book, and I'm like, come on, Doug. Come on, give me the shocking act of violence.
Well, I'll say this. Right. You know, stars were under a lot of pressure at the time to sell records, and a lot of the pressure was put on them by their manager, Bill O'Coyne, and at one of their videotapings, they did kind of film/videotapings back then for promotional purposes, way before MTV. And at one of these tapings, there was an altercation between one of the members of Stars with their manager, Bill O'Coyne. And, you know, some of the band members think that kind of put the kibosh on them ever really getting a fair shake again. You know, they thought that Bill's reaction to the incident pretty much killed their career. You know, I guess some people could see it that way, but it seemed a little strange that he'd keep being their manager and, you know, they'd keep making records with him for a couple of years after that incident.
I will do more on the history of Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, Kiss, and more with Doug Broad when we come back on 720 WGN. There's a little bit of the band called Stars from 1977. And I think it's said what album. No, I don't see what album it was from. But Doug knows.
That was from Violation, the song called Cherry Baby.
Thank you. We're talking with Doug Broad, who's got a great book out called They Just Were a Little Weird, which concentrates on this band that you just heard, Stars, but also a little bit more on Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, and Kiss, and how they sort of reshaped the rock experience during the mid-70s. Now, I have to tell you, I was working at a really big AM rock station during that time, Doug. And I'm familiar with all of these bands except Stars. You know, I met Cheap Trick many times. I met Aerosmith. I saw Kiss without makeup in my studio. My kids refused to go to a Kiss concert because they couldn't stand Gene Simmons' tongue. I mean, you know, I've had my fair share of experience in this time period. And when you were talking about Stars trying to get a hit, this was one of the most difficult things, especially for, in my opinion, for especially bands like these, who were not quote unquote stereotypical top 40 bands. First of all, they had to convince a record company to release something. Most of these bands had songs that were, I don't know, 5 minutes, 6 minutes long, maybe longer, and the record companies insisted on editing those down to maybe three and a half, because that was the length that AM rock stations would accept, generally speaking. To tell you how difficult it was, one of the great Chicago bands, Styx, was around forever before it ever got on the air with Lady. And once they finally broke through, sky's the limit. But these stations had a really strict policy about what they would add. And they had a limited playlist of really only, they said they were top 40, but I'll be darned if they played 40 records. And they had to see success in medium and minor markets, usually speaking, before they could get what was called an ad on a big station's playlist. How much of that did you run into when you were doing the book?
That's a great question. A lot of it, actually, because, you know, as I tried to figure out why a band like Stars didn't make it, one of the reasons I was given by one of the members of the band was that this gentleman named Lee Abrams had something.
Oh, I know Lee Abrams.
Them.
I know Lee Abrams. Yeah, he was sort of a major. He was a major Domo album-oriented rock, quote unquote, guru for a while.
Exactly. Yeah. So I interviewed Lee to sort of get his take on why a band like Stars never made it, and he said that it was not up to him. You know, he was only feeding the stations the music that they liked and they responded to. So, a lot of these bands had to contend with that as well. You know, Kiss had a really hard time at the beginning trying to get a song on the radio, as did Cheap Trick. It wasn't until Kiss had, you know, Rock and Roll All Night from the Alive record, that's when they started getting played. And then after that, it was Death, the more orchestrated power ballady thing. And then with Cheap Trick, it wasn't until another live record for them as well with I Want You to Want Me. I mean, Surrender came out a little bit before. That was a minor hit. It wasn't a pop hit, though. But I Want You to Want Me really broke through for them.
Right. That was at Budokan. And even in that decade, one of the biggest quote-unquote rock albums was a live album from Peter Frampton, which I don't know how many scrillion copies it sold, but he didn't have any kind of hit record anywhere until this live album. And I'm not quite sure what the relationship is with the with it being live and then finding success. But, you know, it's not that important. I mean, first of all, they had to have a song that had a hook. All of this stereotypical requirement to get on the air. But Lee Abrams was a consultant eventually. And I worked at a station that he consulted for a while. And I don't know about the claim I'm giving the radio station the music that those people want to hear. Somewhere before that happened, someone had to make a decision. And if you're relying on a consultant, then it's not necessarily your station's decision as to what to play. So,
well, the consultant in this case, you know, Lee Abrams told me that it was through his extensive research with record buyers. How they determined what the radio station should want to play.
Well, there you have just said the word that destroyed music, and that is research. Rock and roll is not about research. Although they all thought it was, because they wanted to cover their ass, because they wanted to make sure that they had quantitative numbers so they could explain to people in suits who owned the stations why this song was going on. And I'm telling you, I have seen research centers where radio stations employed, I don't know how many different people, 15 on the phones, where they would call and play samples to a cross-section of people who, and then get their reaction. They would have, the other thing was focus groups. Did you ever hear about those? I'm sure you did.
Oh, yeah. You know, they tried everything with the research to try to figure out what could possibly, you know, sell to advertisers and,
And as, you know, the AM rock stations were playing songs, and so the FMs came on and go, AM sucks, AM sucks, we're rock and roll. And then the FM stations became popular, and they employed the same logic in music selection and quote-unquote rotation, if you will, that the AM stations did. And that's why when you tune into a quote-unquote classic rock station these days, you hear the same damn songs over and over and over again. I mean, obviously, they're not producing quote-unquote new classic rock. But my goodness, if you're going to take that as your title, I mean, how many times can you hear? I mean, I'm not saying that these bands are bad or these songs are bad. They're fantastic songs. But if you hear China Grove by the Doobie Brothers more than five times a day, you're probably going to get a little tired of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's funny because, you know, I grew up in New York, and Stars were a New York, New Jersey band, and, you know, that was my sweet spot, 1977, 78. Yeah. I was listening to the radio all the time. I'd never once heard a Stars song. I didn't really discover Stars or actually listen to them until the early 2000s. I always knew they existed. I've seen the logo and the photos. I'd never heard them. And that, to me, was it boggled my mind how this band, who had a presence in the 70s, just totally never made it to me. And I was in New York.
Well, you've done more than 130 interviews in this book, and it's not just, it's producers, roadies, musicians, the entire gamut. Is there some underlying conclusion that you came to after all of this?
No. I mean, I think there's a myriad of arguments that could be made as to why a band like Stars. I mean, there were other bands like them. There was a band like Angel, Montrose, Legs Diamond. There were
yes. I know Montrose.
There were so many. Yeah, there were so many of these bands, and you know, I think all of them have their own kind of special circumstances. And in the case of Stars, they had so many things that were so positive for them. They had great songs, poppy songs, a lot poppier than, you know, Aerosmith records, I would say. They had a great singer in Michael Lee Smith, really great musicianship, but the songs just never penetrated
and
got on the radio for them.
Well, for instance, let's see now, Kiss, Cheap Trick, REO Speedwagon, they also delved into what was the power ballad genre, which was exactly what it was. It was a ballad with a heavy beat. And those songs seem to have a good reception on the part of people who listen to the radio. And most of them were, you know, made it into the top 10, but they weren't what you would call your traditional rock and roll type record. You know, we're going to run out of time, and that's too bad. Maybe we can get you back again, because I want to ask you, you think that Kiss, Cheap Trick, and Aerosmith influenced and changed the rock genre or subgenre. Can you just speak to that while we've got some time?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think I make a pretty good case in the book that all of these bands in their ways really influenced a lot of what came next. When you look at the hair metal guys, the glam metal guys, they all worshipped these bands. And then after that came grunge in the late 80s, early 90s, and so many of those bands were also influenced by these bands, like Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains. They all looked to 70s rock for inspiration. So in a way, I mean, and I interviewed so many musicians, more contemporary musicians, who all pointed to these bands as major influences. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the case could be made that that these four bands built a core for a lot of other genres to flow out of.
Well, certainly Kiss comes to mind immediately as a band that used stage props and put on a show that had really nothing to do with the music, but had to do with explosions and fire and all sorts of stuff. And Alice Cooper was around at that time, and he was biting the heads off of, what did he bite the heads off of? Rabbits, snakes, something, I forget. and, you know, there was this sort of posturing role-playing going on that was not specifically related to the music. And I think that influenced even people like today's music stars, not even in the rock genre, you know, like Jennifer Lopez or hip hop artists who appear on stage with tons of dancers behind them and platform stages. Mm-hmm. And even Madonna. I mean, it took on a whole theatrical group. It wasn't just a two guy. It wasn't a lead guitar, a bass guitar, a keyboard player, and a drummer. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, and that's something I try to get across in the book as well. With these four bands in particular, I mean, before them, you know, you had Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, who were great bands, but there was no theatricality or flamboyance to their performance. They were just guys who came on stage and played. Here were a group of bands that really relied on being on a stage and putting on a show and with makeup and costumes and lights and backdrops.
Listen,
and
I hate
big
to,
logos.
I hate to cut you off, Doug, but we're out of time. Love talking to you. The book is called They Just Seem a Little Weird, How Kiss, Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, and Stars Remade Rock and Roll. It's on Hatchet Books. Thanks for talking with us. I hope to do it again. And rock on, Doug!
My pleasure.